On Friday last week, many of the nation's journalists were jammed together in an Auckland hotel, waiting to find out which of them had won one or more of New Zealand's top awards for journalism, now named the Voyager Media Awards. And so were the staff back at base, who were waiting to put the good news into the papers prominently the next day or onto their news websites straight away. So when the Weekend Herald rolled off the presses that night, it had the proud boast, Newspaper of the Year, at the top of the front page. But the rest of the front page was taken up by a story by another of the night's big winners, investigative reporter Matt Nippert, whose story was all about the IRD targeting the offshore holdings of tycoon Eric Watson. Matt Nippert has been named Reporter of the Year in 2016 and 2017 for stories like that, but this year he won the most coveted prize for award winners, the Wolfson Fellowship. And this is a prize of prestige, but also precious time out, 10 weeks at Cambridge University in the UK to study a subject of significance for the media. So, what's Matt Nippert's thing? Well, he says national borders are now a barrier to investigating significant financial stories in New Zealand about things like tax avoidance, white-collar crime, and today's digital economy. Yet these yarns, he argues, are inherently transnational. He says that close cooperation with journalists overseas can boost the reporting of these issues and make sure that more people get to know all about them. And one of the means of achieving this here in New Zealand is the New Zealand Centre for Investigative Journalism. It has its annual conference at Massey University in Wellington on the weekend of the 9th and 10th of June, where Matt Nippert will be handing out the centre's own awards for local investigative journalism this past year, the Siggies. Now, all journalists and aspiring investigative reporters are welcome. You'll find the details for the conference at cij.org.nz. But while Matt Nippert's mission of putting New Zealand journalism into the orbit of reporters and resources overseas sounds good, how can it actually be done?
The problems I'm facing, and a lot of financial journalists are facing, is that, following the money is all well and good, but what do you do when it goes to the Caymans? Because it's very difficult to keep following it from that point. So, and a lot of these structures are used both in sort of multinational taxation and also in organised crime. I don't want to conflate the two. They're clearly different in a legal sense, but they use very similar structures, and that effectively is having parties to a transaction being in different jurisdictions, the vehicles processing the payments for these transactions being in yet other jurisdictions, and then often there's banks in yet other jurisdictions being used, and finally there's directors that you can occasionally find who are, you know, based in other parts of the world, and trying to unpick these and get answers as to what exactly happened becomes incredibly difficult. I mean, I know the New Zealand Companies Act quite well, but of course that's not really extraterritorial. A fair amount of work goes to Australia, and they've got a whole different range of registries and laws. I do have some people over there who help out. But just as an example of how this works, a couple of years ago, I think when I was at the Sunday Star Times, I came across a New Zealand company called Premier Partners that was being liquidated. Someone in the UK, I think, had felt they'd been ripped off by its parent. And the liquidators had chased the money to this New Zealand subsidiary. But they ran into enormous problems when the director of the New Zealand subsidiary was a Russian national, appeared to be a university student. I'm unclear as to whether they were actually behind it. And then the New Zealand company had set up bank accounts in Latvia, through which it paid the money out to other outfits in Eastern Europe. And the New Zealand liquidator had no hope. And that's a New Zealand liquidator running a sort of administration for a New Zealand company has legal powers far beyond I do as a journalist. All my stuff relies on sort of informal consent to chase the stuff, and they basically had to throw their hands up. And that's a really small, discreet example about how difficult this can be.
So what would actually help you then as a journalist, Matt, trying to investigate a financial story that is transnational, but do you need basically a network of like-minded people with knowledge of other markets overseas and, you know, foreign language skills you don't have? Is that what you require?
Well, broadly, yes, that's pretty much what works. I mean, I've managed to build up a small network of sort of colleagues and assistants around the world. I've got, obviously, Australia's a good one. I've got a couple of journos over there that I'll run searches in New Zealand databases and they'll do them in Australia for me. Got a few in the UK. But it's extremely informal, and there's... and if it goes beyond that, I often run into trouble. I'm often, you may notice, my Twitter account occasionally has sort of panic calls for, I need a Portuguese translator.
Yeah.
I need someone that can translate Chinese documents. And it's, you can make it work, but it's very difficult without someone with equal expertise. And I think there's a real opening, given that these transnational stories often are of interest to audiences in both or all countries where the transaction touches down, that you can find, if I had the ability to find other journalists working in similar areas and work with them and each sort of handle the legwork in your jurisdiction, I think could be extremely valuable.
But how many journalists are there out there, well, both within New Zealand and in this broader network you might hope to create, that are really willing and able to do this pretty specialised job of churning through, you know, big data, leaks, large spreadsheets, etc., to create specific news stories? I mean, are there enough of them?
There's a handful in New Zealand that are happy to pitch in with this sort of stuff. Gareth Vaughan at Interest is one that springs to mind, and Michael Field has a particular interest in shell companies and the like. There's a few people. It'll be always nice to have more, but it is a fairly specialised area. But I mean, I managed to pick up most of my sort of working knowledge on how company structures work and within 6 months at MBR. So it's, we're not sort of needing MBA trained people to come in and help out here.
Sure. Hey, you mentioned the Panama Papers, and that'll be a story a lot of people will be familiar with to some degree. Now, in that, there was cooperation, wasn't there? We had Television New Zealand and RNZ got together on it, put reporters in a room with Nikki Hager, who's affiliated to the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, and had the data. I mean, was that not effective? Because, you know, you seem to be saying in your proposal that actually that could have been done a lot better and perhaps even in a more timely way.
Well, if you look, I mean, I remember because I was desperately trying to chase that story too, and the stories broke internationally, and there's references to, you know, I think particularly the New Zealand trusts used by senior figures in the Maltese government. We had no idea what was going on, and these stories have been worked on for months by international journalists. I mean, New Zealand, yes, RNZ and TVNZ did come to the party late. I think Hager is the only New Zealand member of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. He's a great reporter and journalist, but he's just one man, and I think at that time he was also likely working on another project called Hit and Run. And it was only after the stories broke internationally that the New Zealand outlets were able to sort of join that international reporting effort. And I think there was a real missed trick there, that the New Zealand angles could have been much more front and centre, and also the connections to these New Zealand entities could have been far better reported in the New Zealand press if we had been cut in at the formation stage of the Panama Papers, rather than sort of basically an impromptu working group formed after the fact to try to mop up some sort of the remnants.
And in fact, in the past year or 18 months or so, I can recall one of your stories that made quite an impact was about the tax paid, or more to the point, not paid by really big global corporate names here in New Zealand. Once you seed it, you put it out there, is it a story that can be taken on?
I guess the best example to talk about here is to the problems you run into with these multiple jurisdictions is with Apple, because its structure is not particularly simple. It's, to be honest, it's one of the more transparent ones. It reports all its New Zealand revenue in accounts filed with the company's office. But what isn't entirely clear until I think February last year, when I discovered this, is that it's never paid tax in New Zealand and it's instead paid tax in Australia. And so to understand sort of where the money from New Zealand goes, you need to get into the accounts filed with the Australian company's office, which in turn, I think, there's been some great work out by the Australian Financial Review, and they found, surprise, surprise, all their money was going to Ireland, where they had a remarkably friendly tax rate. And just to bundle this all together again, so after the Paradise Papers came out, it became apparent that Apple wasn't very keen on all the publicity it was getting around its operations in Ireland, and they were actively looking at moving to Jersey. Which, you know, just shows that, you know, even if you, you know, report these and shine the light on sort of interesting corporate activities, you need to keep that spotlight on because they will naturally tend towards the shadows.
And so when will you be able to go to Cambridge and take your 10 weeks out to try and research all this and then come back and put something into place?
Well, I think the term we're looking at is around April next year till the end of June. So I expect to maybe report back to the CIJ conference next year.
And actually, for those who don't know the CIJ, can you tell us a little bit about that, you know, quite why it was put together and what it does that maybe other gatherings of journalists don't or can't do in New Zealand?
Yeah, I've found it to be an extremely valuable community. It's a sort of grassroots organisation run on entirely a volunteer basis, mostly by coalface reporters who put together a sort of annual conference of things we want to hear about, people talking through stories we admired, how we can replicate them, things the reporter did wrong and did right. It's very collegial. There's usually a good night at the pub there. It's one of the few opportunities you have outside of sort of the specialist investigative teams, and I'm lucky enough to work in one of those, to just talk nuts and bolts of the really difficult, crunchy stories, ones that might not necessarily make the front page, but I think at the real heart of what we do.
You've just won the big and most coveted prize at the National Media Awards, the Voyager Media Awards, as they're now known, but for the first time at the Centre for Investigative Journalism annual get-together, there will be awards as well for investigative journalism, won't there?
Yeah, I raised this possibility last year that we had everyone coming together. I think also last year there was the prospect of the merger hanging over the newspaper industry, and also I think the previous sponsor of the media awards, Canon, had stepped back, so there was the possibility that there'd be nothing in the years to come. So yes, we've kicked off what we're referring to as the SIGGIs, just trying to find the best investigative story. And also the best investigative story by a sort of a promising journalist that's someone in the first 5 years of their career, just a way for us to give acknowledgement to people whose work isn't, you know, quite podium worthy, but they've got a lot of their career to go, and we want to really encourage them to keep at it.
But I suppose the resources of the CIJ wouldn't be such that you can offer people 10 weeks off work and a trip to the UK.
No. I think I'm getting some pens made with some branding. It certainly won't be black tie either. I suspect we may have a couple of pints.
Is there a sort of paradox in this, though, that often, you know, scoops, media companies love them to be exclusive, and there's a kind of need for secrecy? So if you're talking about building a network of journalism without borders that New Zealand can tap into, is that difficult to work on a really sensitive story where journalists working for rival outfits, you know, all get a share in the facts?
Yeah, I'm particularly interested in finding out how the ICIJ managed to pull this off with the Panama Papers. I mean, journalists are fairly egotistic at the best of times, and managing to keep, you know, have hundreds of them all agreeing to keep to embargoes. It's quite dramatic.
Yeah, indeed. And the editor's probably not keen for it to go beyond the room that they sit in. Yeah.
Although, I mean, I imagine ways in dealing with that are to basically divide these stories up by audience. And so each story, you'll be basically, again, looking at the elephant from different angles, and your readers, you know, from my perspective, the New Zealand readers will be particularly interested in the New Zealand angle to the story. And so being able to write it with that sort of front and centre, the risk of that story going overseas is probably quite slim.
Mm. And the other thing about this that strikes me is these are complicated stories, as you say, but are these also stories that really suit the modern multimedia environment? That's kind of a time has come for these stories. We can illustrate things graphically, interactively, that are complicated. You don't have to sum them all up in a kind of broadcast track or a written blob of text that set in the page.
No, there's certainly, there's been some great work done by some of the sort of top tier international papers. You know, the old wiring diagrams that were just two or three boxes and some straight lines are long gone. You can see some of the, particularly around the 1MDB case out of Malaysia, you know, that big fraud that appears to have led to the Malaysian Prime Minister losing power. Mm. Some of the reporting on that has been stupendous, and there have been some insanely complex transactions there that have been summed down to neat little sort of graphics that sort of stop motion GIFs almost that can be shared on Twitter. And I don't think the financial journalists of, you know, even 5 years ago would have imagined that happening.
And I mean, you mentioned the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, Nikki Haga, working with them and has done on, say, the Panama and Paradise Papers stories in the past. I think you want to get accredited to them and start working with them too. But here in New Zealand, shortly, the New Zealand's investigative journalists and those who want to be will be meeting at their annual conference. Is the Centre for Investigative Journalism here a group that can play a role in the sort of transnational cooperation that, you're seeking to put together?
Yeah, well, that's sort of at the centre of it. When I was trying to look at my proposal, I was trying to work up a framework that would work independently of separate publishers. The last thing I wanted is effectively to have my course of study end up behind sort of a corporate paywall, although a lot of my work undoubtedly will. So I was intending on using the NZCIJ as a clearinghouse for these sort of requests. You know, anyone interested in reporting on this area can flag that, likely with me with my CIJ hat on, and then we can make a decision as to who's best placed to partner with overseas outlets, and also vice versa. It's much easier to sort of ask for assistance from if you've got an outlet like the CIJ behind you than if you're just a reporter in a random newsroom from a country, let's be honest, most overseas journalists will only be vaguely familiar with.
If there are journalists out there or even researchers, people with skills that you think you'd need that might not consider themselves, you know, part of an investigative journalism outfit currently, what sort of skills do you think you'd need, the sort of people you'd like to talk to or perhaps, you know, bring into this effort?
Yeah, I mean, the people I've worked with in the past on these sort of stories tend to be from, you know, law enforcement, liquidators, sort of international lawyers. I mean, I've even talked to some slightly shady people who work in the trust sector.
Okay, and, no need to go into details there.
So often most of them have a different perspective to bring to the table. The core requirement for a journalist is just, you know, the ability to keep asking questions. If you don't understand something, there's no way you read as well. So you have to keep asking the stupid questions until you get the smart answers.
That was Matt Nippett from the New Zealand Herald, who won the Wolfson Fellowship at the Voyager Media Awards last week. He's also a key member of the New Zealand Centre for Investigative Journalism, which has its annual get-together at Massey University in Wellington on the weekend of the 9th and 10th of June, where Matt Nippett himself will be handing out the centre's own awards, recognising great investigative journalism in New Zealand this past year. And all journalists and aspiring investigative reporters are welcome. You'll find the details at cij.org.nz.